Dear John, we're very eager to hear about faith, immigration, security, and the economy. Let me turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. We were given the task to keep you tied over until dinner, so hopefully we'll keep you engaged and informed. As you just heard, this panel is called Faith, Immigration, Security, and Economy. And our hope, our desire, our prayer is to give you information to equip you to navigate both the thinking and conversations going forward within your own faith communities. And we have four great top-notch experts to help us do just that.
Yeah, really, really such a delight to be here with all of you, and so appreciate your hearts in the last two panels. Everything that you have shared is just really spoken deeply to us, so thank you for that. So switching gears with this panel, I'm really excited about our panelists. They are not only people of deep committed faith to Jesus Christ, but they are people who are experts in the fields of security and the economy, and just the business place and how it intersects with immigration. So really excited to equip you by hearing what their expertise is in these areas and how it relates to immigration or human migration. I liked that phrase. And just to briefly, I know you have the bios, but just such great backgrounds. Elizabeth Newman currently serves as the Chief Strategy Officer at Moonshot, which seeks tech-driven solutions to violent extremism in the online world. And she's the former Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism at the Department of Homeland Security. And Mark Prosser had a distinguished law enforcement career that includes 30 years working as Chief of Police in Storm Lake, Iowa. That's where I met him. And he currently serves as assistant to the Bishop of the Sioux City Catholic Diocese.
And we also have John Erb at the end. He is the Chief Operating Officer of Roy Farms in Washington State. He's also a former Vice President at Driscoll's, which is the world's largest berry company. I was just about to make news by saying it was the world's largest, but it is the world's largest berry company. And he's focused on international business development and labor issues. We also have to my immediate right, Adrian Botta. He himself is a refugee who escaped what was then communist Romania. He is also an entrepreneur and the co-founder and CEO of Origin Milk, an innovative dairy company based in Ohio.
All right, and these are going to be more policy-oriented questions, but I also want to encourage all of you panelists just to bring your, we want to invite you to share your faith and how that's informing your perspective on all these issues as well. But Elizabeth, I wanted to start with you, because I think as we all have experienced, especially just coming through this campaign season, I mean, I was on the campaign trail covering candidates, and all they had to say was the word border. And that was like the word, you know, they would just say that. And so I want to ask you to equip the people in this room who are pastors, denominational leaders, thought leaders, what can you tell us in terms of security concerns about people who are coming over the border, particularly our southern border? What can you share from your experience, from your vantage point about, I'm just going to say security at the border?
Well, first of all, to those that are in the room, taking time out of your very busy lives to learn about this issue and to advocate for this issue, thank you. The change that we need in the country as it pertains to immigration is going to happen through you. It is not going to happen through security experts like myself or policy people in Washington. That those are needed, it really will be, I think, a heart change that brings us to a better approach to immigration. You already know this, but let me be clear. Immigration is used as a political tool for votes and for money on both sides. Security is the language that they use to shroud their arguments. And I bought it, hook, line, and sinker, because I'm a security person. I've done security for 20 years, since 9/11. And in 2016, I was not paying attention to the election. I was living in Dallas and raising two little ones and juggling a career, and I didn't have time to pay attention to that election stuff. And my background is counterterrorism, not immigration, so I wasn't really paying too close attention. And another story for another day, ended up coming into the Trump administration after saying no three times, and ended up with the portfolio to strengthen our screening and vetting because we got to keep terrorists out. And I assumed that the premise was correct because we had had some attacks in recent years that indicated that we had some weaknesses in our vetting system. So I look under the hood and I start working with all of these amazing experts all across the intelligence community and the immigration USCIS community. And you come to find out, actually, a lot of the things that were not perfect or refined had been fixed. You remember that Christmas Day attack, 2010? There was a failed attempt at a bombing of an airliner coming from overseas. And there was a lot of scrutiny after that. How did he get on a plane? And we should have caught it. And after that, there was some real work on watch listing that was done. I won't bore you with details. But when I come back into government and I start looking at what we had done, you come away with, like, actually, the system's working really well. So, for me, I had this realization that the rhetoric that was being used, not by all, but by many, on the Republican side, wasn't really based in reality. Now, I think a lot of people thought it was, because screening and vetting is kind of complex, and I'm telling you there's probably like five people in the entire government that actually know how it all works. Like, everybody knows their little slice. So it is complex, and I will give the benefit of the doubt to many that they were doing the right thing and assuming that we needed to do better. But I came away from the experience of looking into our screening and vetting systems and realizing we're doing quite well. There's always room for improvement. You want to talk to me about policy improvements? We always need more resources. We always need more people, asylum officers, refugee officers. Most of our workforce is so overspent. Like, they're asked to do too much. And they love their jobs and they give it all. So sure, we could be doing better as it pertains to properly funding things or properly resourcing. And as many of you probably know, some of these systems, like USCIS, used to be entirely paper-based until recently. So there's always room for improvement, but in terms of, are there major gaps? Are terrorists getting through? No, they're not. But let me add one caveat. Today was the worldwide threats hearing that they usually do around 9/11. That House version was held a little late this year. So you had FBI Director Wray, Secretary Mayorkas, the National Counterterrorism Director Abizaid, all testifying about the threats that we're facing. They talked about China, they talked about Russia, they talked about terrorism, and they talked about the southern border. And they did acknowledge that we have seen an uptick in known and suspected terrorists coming across the border. Now, they stated publicly, sometimes that number gets classified, but Congressman McCaul made a statement during the hearing today that there were 98 in the last fiscal year. 98 known and suspected terrorists. Now, if we were to say that that's 98 ISIS, I, as a counterterrorism professional, would be very, very concerned. What I think is more likely, knowing how the system works, is that it's more the suspected category, and that suspected category got expanded after that 2010 attack. So that if the US government has any question at all whether you might have an association with a known terrorist or a suspected terrorist, we're just going to put you on the list. In case you ever come across our border, we want to have that flag so we can do extra screening of you. It does not mean that you're actually suspected of terrorism. It means there's something, there was some encounter somewhere in the global world that made us wonder, is there a nexus there? It literally could be that you happen to be in the same coffee shop at the same time as a bad guy. So, when it's that broad, it means that a huge number of our hits or our encounters, and most of which, by the way, are virtual, most of our encounters occur when somebody is trying to come over to the United States on an airplane. We see them because of the passenger manifest, and we say, no, you can't come. So most of our encounters are not in person, but usually those encounters get resolved and it's like not the person we were looking for, or turns out, like, no, they're clean, there's nothing wrong with them. So the watch list has been greatly criticized for being bloated, for needing to be cleaned up, all of which I agree with. It's pretty hard to do, and again, it's a resourcing problem. But when I see 98 encounters over the last year, to me, what that is we have people, a number of people on the list that may or may not need to be on that list. And anytime you have an increase, a surge in migration, you're going to have an increase in that hit number. But if you look at it as a percentage, the percentage has stayed the same. It's just we've had more people coming to the southern border. So I'm not brushing it aside. I'm a security person through and through. I want to know who's coming into the country. I want to know that you are who you say you are. And I want to know that you don't intend any harm. Those seem really basic. And that's what screening and vetting should do. And it's better if we can have people come in an orderly fashion so that we can do that screening properly. So we do have a problem on the border, but I think it is so often dramatized that you can't ever solve the problem. And when you use numbers like there are 98 terrorists, it's not an accurate description of what is actually happening.
That's really helpful. And I'm just going to ask a quick follow-up question, but when the other argument that I know we've all heard in this room is that we've got to watch out because immigrants are committing crime. So what can you say with respect to...
It's not true.
What can you tell us? Because I know people in this room are having, you know, hearing these, having these conversations.
So I dug into this about 2 years ago and I wrote a paper for the Immigration Forum. It is available on the website, but there is data that shows that crime rates in immigration in communities with high immigrant populations are lower than the average crime rate in the surrounding areas. If you look at terrorism data, sadly, we've had the majority of our terrorist attacks and plots since 1994 have come from domestic actors. And I don't mean inspired by ISIS. I mean like right-wing violent extremists, racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists, and anti-government extremists. This is CSIS data, if anybody wants to look it up. If you take out 9/11 for fatalities, the majority of fatalities from terrorist attacks have come from that right-wing violent extremist ideology. So I am much, much, much more concerned about domestic violent extremists. We do not have a good handle on that. Another topic for another day. That is where the threat is greatest. FBI director said it again today at the hearing. He's much more concerned about lone actors. That doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to secure our border. We do. It's just let's acknowledge that the threat from within is actually much graver than the threat outside of our borders.
Thanks, Elizabeth. All right, and we want to turn to Mark Prosser, who I had the privilege of meeting back in, I think it was 2014, in Storm Lake, Iowa. And Mark has the, to take it from the national perspective right now to the local community perspective, you came from a career, law enforcement career in St. Louis to Storm Lake, Iowa, and discovered that your community was on, I think at the, and to use this freedom of movement term, but your community was becoming diverse right before your eyes. And talk about from a policing perspective, how you engaged your community that was had a lot of different groups and a lot of different perspectives.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. Storm Lake, Iowa is a small community wrapped around the body of water Storm Lake in northwest Iowa, unattached to any urban center, or what few urban centers exist in Iowa. It is your classic, it has large packing plants that and ag-based industries and things like that. And it is a community that over the last 35 to 40 years has completely reinvented itself. It has 30 languages spoken there. 90% of the public school system, pre-K through 12, are children of color. It has, I don't know how many different paraprofessional programs that are multilingual. It's the most diverse community in the state of Iowa and the most diverse public school system in the state of Iowa. And the parochial Catholic school system is about 60% students of color. And this all happened in a period of about 3.5 decades. So that if you can think about a traditional white, conservative, rural community To change that rapidly, it was dramatic. And I arrived in 1989 with a professional plan of being there about 3 years and then heading back to St. Louis. And I ended up finishing 30 years as their police chief because it was such an interesting and rewarding place to live. And it was an interesting and rewarding place to live because of our people of color, because of our immigrants, because of the diversity that brought a richness and a youth and a vitality to that community that most other communities, and certainly in rural Iowa and in the rural Midwest, do not and have not experienced, but will as our country continues to change. What we saw in the early 90s, talking about local crime rates and impact, is the crime totals in Storm Lake started to go up, and they started to get more urban types of crime there on a more frequent basis. And that lasted for a while. And so those who weren't supporters of immigration, of diversity, of new ideas and new people coming to a community, mostly those people who were not residents of Storm Lake, who were on the outside looking in, were saying, well, look at Storm Lake, it's becoming more diverse. It has more crime. Guess what? One and one equals, and it didn't. They would come up with, it's the immigrants who were committing the crime. So in 1992, we started publicly reporting all of our crimes annually by ethnicity and gender, and it's done today. It was a tip that I got at a community policing seminar in Los Angeles in 1991. They said, if you are policing a community that's shifting its demographics, that's changing, you want to be as transparent as possible. So we started pushing that out. And in my entire tenure there, there was not one year where there was any disproportionate representation of any ethnic group in criminal activity. And I say that because the numbers of crimes were going up because we were the only community in rural Iowa that was growing. And so the raw numbers were going up, but it was never attributed disproportionately to any particular ethnic group. And that, we battled that publicly. When I say we, mayor, city manager, city council, we asked why this community so embraced diversity. There's a lot of different reasons, and a lot of good people, and also the grace of God that worked through that community. And so that's what made it a good place to live. But we continued to deal with that to the point where the superintendent of schools, the executive director of the medical center, and the police chief, we went on the speaking tour to go out in these communities across Iowa and say, hey, you people are closing and shuttering your schools and consolidating with the next three towns. We're building brand new schools. You people have closed storefronts and a need for business and a workforce. We are expanding our packing plants and our downtown business. We are building water parks and hotels. And the reason we're doing that, and that growth and that vibrancy, is 100% because of our shift in demographics and our immigrants who came and called Storm Lake home. And so that ultimately led me across the country for the last 30 years telling the story of that community and dispelling the myth to support the study that immigrants commit more crimes. They commit crime at a lower rate, and if they are undocumented, they commit crime at a lower rate yet. And they are more victimized than anything, but they can't come out of those shadows, and that's why we work very hard on that relationship building. And I just want to tell you one more thing. In 2019, our community was, and it's a city of 14,000 people, but it's the largest it had been in history. It was the most diverse it had been in history. And it had the lowest crime rate in 25 years. So do the math. We can read the studies, which I support. We lived that experience in that community, and they continue to live it today.
Mark, just briefly, you had talked to me on the phone about how you were very intentional about reaching out to the community. Talk a little bit about that, because you weren't just sitting back saying this is great, the crime rate is low. You were reaching out to specific community groups.
That's correct. Early in the 90s, we knew that we had to deal now in a multilingual scenario, and many folks were coming from many different life experiences. And we also knew that, our immigrant brothers and sisters did not do business like the traditional conservative whites of Northwest Iowa. If they had something to say, they'd come to a city council meeting. If they had something to say, they'd come in and chew on the police chief's ear. And that was not the style or the history of our many folks who came from Mexico, Central and South America, Southeast Asia, South Africa, and so on. And so we were very intentional on making sure that we were a police department that was a police department for everyone. And so we took our show on the road in the community and started attending to any and every event that we were invited to, knowing that if someone had a concern or if they were victimized, they're not going to come to the police station or call the cops to file a report. So we need to make sure they know that we're there for them. And we also, I was very outspoken, that local law enforcement should not be in the immigration business. We are not going to do immigration enforcement. I will tell you that in the early 90s, I supported, and this was long before ICE and Homeland Security, it would have been INS, if you remember those terms, immigration naturalization. They did a plant raid in our community. Law enforcement assisted on the logistics. It was the worst mistake that I ever made as a police chief when I saw the pain that it shot through that community. And I publicly committed to our mayor and council and to the public that that police department, as long as I was chief, would never cooperate with an event like that again. And so then we started building out neighborhood outreach programs all the time. Not one event here or one event there. This was every week or every other night in a different neighborhood, taking the police department and support services and stuff to the parking lots, to the street corners and so on, and going and knocking doors and meeting people, to church gatherings, and going in and talking about immigration services and the administrator, how can we help bring services in, and that we want you to come and feel comfortable if you've been victimized, because we're your police department too. We did videos in multiple languages, saying, just sharing the statement, we're here for you, in English and Spanish and in Lao and in Vietnamese, we're your cops too. So come and talk to us and let's be that. So that evolved with time. Made some mistakes along the way. It's not heaven. I'm just telling you, racism is alive and well there. We made mistakes as a law enforcement agency, but we tried to learn and evolve from that to where it is today, and the current chief continues that.
Thank you.
You know, our hope is, of course, rooted in Christ Jesus, but hearing that that can happen in Storm Lake, Iowa, that's hopeful. So thank you for sharing that. In the news, it was reported today that we just crossed a new threshold. The United Nations projected that there are now 8 billion people on the planet. With that, we have limited resources. So what I would like to do is turn the conversation a little bit towards immigration and the economy. As I've been sitting here and listening to some of the other panelists talk, one of the recurring themes that we've heard is this theme of fear. And we know that the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy, and I think he plays up on our fears. So when we talk about the economy where there is rising inflation, rising interest rates, and fear of possible recession, it's about a lack of resources. And perhaps looking at the other as taking opportunities away. So John, as someone who has both international and domestic agricultural experience, I'd love for you to talk about what are the things that weigh most on your mind when it comes to the intersection of labor and immigration. What's consuming most of your thought and your conversations?
Farm workers are the lifeline for growers that deal with specialty crops or labor-intensive crops. I worked with a colleague who managed 5 acres of strawberries, and her brothers came from Nebraska and laughed that she needed 20 people for 5 acres. They would manage thousands of acres of corn with themselves and one other person. But when you talk about lettuce or berries or milk or other things like that, it just requires a tremendous amount. And the supply of labor just isn't there. Birth rates have dropped in Mexico and other areas around the world. It's actually a global issue. I was in Portugal a few years ago on a raspberry farm and asked the HR director how many countries are represented here. She said over 20.
Wow.
Most of which were from Nepal and India, this is in Portugal. So it's really really is the lifeline. And you see it in all the metrics. If you look at the guest worker program, the H2A program, it's been like an 11 to 12 years span of time. The numbers have about quadrupled. You know, it was about 80,000 workers, now it's around 300,000 workers. And growers typically don't want to, that's not their first option, you know, because you are required federally mandated to provide housing, you have to provide transportation, the bureaucratic components to it are very challenging, and then you also have to pay the adverse effect wage rate, which is significantly higher than minimum wage. So, you know, as far as from a grower perspective, the availability of labor is first and foremost, because you have to get the job done, you have to get the operations, you got to bring the crop in. And, you know, depending on the crop, there's specific challenges. So I work in blueberries and hops and apples, and each one of those are very very different, you know, in terms of the nature of it. So a blueberry crop comes in, and you try to hand harvest that, and we have to bring in hundreds, about 1,000 workers within a 2-month period of time. You get into hops, and it's, you know, 30 days, you have to get the entire crop in. So we do 40,000 to 50,000 truckloads 24/7 in a 30-day period. So then if you talk about overtime or different things, you know, it's super challenging depending on what you're dealing with. But, you know, as far as within that context, you know, it's easy as, let's say, if you're running a business, to just say, well, I just need what I need, and whatever it takes to get it, that's what we're going to do. But when it's not a hammer or some inanimate tool, it's people we're talking about here, and they're made in the image of God. So, you know, as a Christian, bringing my perspective into this, you know, when you think of someone who's made in the image of God, it really means, you know, just not just kind of this otherworldly picture of the image of God, but it's like a whole person. It's someone that has a family, potentially. It's someone that has a whole life that has potential. And so, you know, I think about that a lot, you know, when I walk the floor at the packing facility, or if I'm out in the fields, it's really learning their name and looking at them as a human being, just like me. And so I think that gets lost a lot of times. What I see with family farms, oftentimes, you know, I work with a fifth generation farmer. There's a gentleman by the name of Narciso who works in an organization who's been there for over 50 years. So when you think about the fourth generation owner who's 7 years old now, he basically grew up in Narciso and he was doing farm work. But when you look at larger corporate farms, oftentimes people do get reduced down to a number. And unfortunately, family farms are kind of going by the wayside. And so partly because of just trying to keep up with regulations, you need this huge back office and how you spread, you know, fixed costs. We only have a small operation. So those are several things that keep me up at night.
John, I'm glad you brought up the Francisco part, because during our phone call the other day, that was something that stood out to me, the loyalty that you have with these workers who have been with these families for generations. Real quickly, we heard someone bring up the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. There's a plant march that's going to happen in the coming week to try to advance that in the Senate. It's already passed in the House. You know, opponents say that it would create a complicated and limited path to legal status, among other issues. I'm curious, since you work in the space, what's your position? And then on the back end, is the support for it too economically driven?
Well, it's absolutely needed, first of all, just to improve the current guest worker program, which this legislation does. So it streamlines the process for the grower or the farm labor contractor that's trying to bring the people in. So instead of having to navigate three or four different regulatory organizations, you know, you have one place to go. There's also assistance for housing. So, you know, as growers, we really want to be investing in becoming, you know, in the real estate market and housing and those types of things. We'd rather invest the money in mechanization or in new technologies or better irrigating crops and that type of thing. So there's some assistance there. You know, for dairy farmers, there's a provision for year-round folks, which is desperately needed. So I would say from a business standpoint, it's not revolutionary, but it is helpful. What really bugs me is that it's as if at the border we have kind of a no trespassing sign to get, hey, please come in, we desperately need you. you know, to put food on our tables in the country. And so, you know, it's ironic because you'll have an ice raid, let's say, and this happened to one of the largest vegetable farms from where I'm from, and over 87% of the workers were undocumented, yet they, you know, passed the test with flying colors because they did everything they were supposed to do, you know, getting the I-9s filled out and everything properly. So they're doing everything properly, and yet, you know, what is going on here? It just doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, from obviously from an immigrant perspective, that it's living in the shadows, and there's all kinds of vulnerabilities associated with that, no matter if, you know, it's on the farm or off in the community, your landlord's doing something, what's your recourse, you know, on all the fear? People won't even go into a medical clinic because they're fearful of getting their name out there, etc. And so, so this legislation allows for becoming a certified ag worker, and depending on how long you've served in agriculture, there's different time frames by which you can become, get a green card, and eventually you can qualify for citizenship. And I, you know, thinking about being made in the image of God and the whole person piece, you know, we've had people on the farm become citizens, and it's just amazing. You know, we'll do little parties for them, it's like, and the joy that's on their face, it's a total game changer. And so I think as someone who grew up in this country, it's easy to take that for granted. So I feel very strongly. This isn't the only way to put a legislative package together. But I think it's a very strong piece of legislation. Unfortunately, it's only carved out for ag. So more comprehensive reform is desperately needed as well. But I think it really checks the boxes in my mind of some of the criteria I would have for what is a just package. I think the other piece too, just in terms of you know, the, let's say maybe the more conservative pushback of like, the border, and let's build a bigger wall, and this type of thing. I really feel that, well, what happens too is that after a period of time, 6 to 15 months, depending on the size of the employee that you are then required to electronically verify the person's social security number. And so what that would do is essentially make kind of the demand for illegal workers, if you think of it that way, undocumented workers, go away. Because reputable employers, they will comply and they will electronically verify the social security number. I have no doubt about that in the vast majority of cases. And so then, you know, if someone's illegally crossing the border, they're gonna show up to get employed, and the employer's just gonna turn away. And so you're addressing kind of the demand for unlawful workers, if you think of it that way.
John, thank you. We are getting short on time, so what I'd like to do is just ask Adrian a quick question, and then we'll open up the floor to the room in case there are questions that anyone would like to ask. Adrian, you have your personal experience fleeing from what was then communist Romania. I know that shapes your work outside of what you do with Origin. I know that you've traveled, we talked, to Afghanistan to help with activation and humanitarian needs. You've been to Ukraine several times. From your perspective, looking at these hotspot areas, visiting places where there are refugee camps, have things gotten any better from the time where you experienced your fleeing, where you stayed in prisons and you stayed in refugee camps? And if not, why is that? What can we do to improve?
Great question. I'm also very thankful and grateful to be here and for folks being interested in this topic. So I spent time in three, we were talking about this, I believe at the end it was four refugee camps. One is still there, Tereskirchen. It's just outside of Austria, outside of Vienna in Austria. And there are now Syrian refugees there. And then we spent some time in a Hungarian prison when folks in the U.S. government tried to cross us over, after we crossed ourselves over from Romania to Hungary, then they said, well, we'll take over from here, we'll get you over, you know, and that didn't work out so well at first. So it took three tries to get across, and there was some of that involvement there with us ending up in a communist Hungarian prison. I would say that the situation around the world today is not just worse, but markedly worse than it was back then. And It's perhaps because we, you know, there's an issue of numbers. There are more displaced people around the world today than there were then. Although, you know, as you and I talked, you know, the significance of actually today or the last few days in history of my personal history, what happened about 30 years ago today or about today, the Berlin Wall came down, was the other great movement of people in Europe, right? And so what we see, what we saw happening then is people flooded out of the Eastern Bloc into those refugee camps. The situation certainly got worse just overnight because now you're limited on resources allocating to that many folks. And us being a family of five, for instance, and another Kurdish-Iraqi family of five who was the only family to survive the Saddam's gassing in their village, they ended up in the same camp as us, and they took these two families of five kids, you know, parents and five kids, and moved us to this small town so that we could have access to some education and kind of be in a little safer situation as opposed to being in the tents. And so today around the world, whether it's on the ground, you know, what I saw with my own eyes over the border in Afghanistan a year ago today, or what we see happening on the ground in certain parts of Ukraine, or in certain parts of South and Central America, never mind Southeast Asia, is very, very different. I will have to say the one difference is the way that my homeland, Romania, where I was born and raised for the most part, or Poland or other countries have opened their doors in a way that I couldn't believe. When I got there and I saw Romanians on the border, it literally brought me to tears. Mm-hmm. Because one thing about the Eastern Europeans that grew up under communism, once communism fell, it was all about me. It was no longer about some kind of community. Like, nope, now I'm gonna like become rich, and if that means you become poor, great, that's fine. And you know what, this has been said by others, what the US or NATO or others couldn't do, Putin did real quick, is he united Europeans and Eastern Europeans in a way that I just couldn't. If I wanted to have my kids go there and see this, because you had, you know, Baptist pastors next to Catholic priests, next to Jehovah's Witness, and like the hipsters, you know, feeding, you know, vegan hot dogs or whatever. Everybody was on the border helping people cross over, and it was remarkable to see. So that has been encouraging. If we could have that replicated at refugee camps around the world, wow, that would be amazing. So I'm not sure what the secret sauce is there, but if we could see that, that would be great. But otherwise, what's happening, say, on the southern border or in other places is really a disgrace. I say this, and I'm sure this is okay to say, I don't need to be political, those godless communists in Romania and Hungary, especially in Hungary, looked at a bunch of, you know, Baptists, this guy, my dad, with five kids and a baby in his arms, and put us in refugee camps and then put us in a prison, couldn't figure out what to do with us. Literally, when they let us go from that prison, it was because the general in charge of that military base was not sure what to do. He just had never seen someone cross over like this. And we asked my dad, like, hey, are you either, you know, mentally ill, or was it really that bad? And my dad said it was really that bad. So he took the file, we ripped it up, and said, all right, you know, go on your merry way. We'll pretend like this never happened. And you know what they didn't do is there was no separation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So they didn't take my dad or us five, you know. There was only one cot, so we had the floor and the girls got the bed, but they didn't separate anybody. And so, you know, I don't know, you can educate us more on what's actually happening with separation or not. I'm sure a lot of it is real, some of it is not, etc. But anybody that's separating any family member, you know, an adult, a parent from kids in America, which is why we came here, so that wouldn't happen. And again, those communists in Hungary didn't do that. That's really telling. There's something going on there. So we as a country, we can't control what else happens around the world, but we certainly can control what happens here. And that's a really, really important moral imperative that we have. Wow. That not happening.